Today we're going to talk about wilderness in an American context. So first of all, remember that the word wilderness has to be pronounced for some weird reason. Wilderness, although the adjective is wild. So what I want to talk about today is wilderness and its significance in American culture and American history. Okay, so I'm sure some of you have visited the United States, and if you did at one point, you might have seen so-called wilderness areas. So I'll say a few words about those wilderness areas later on. These are protected federal lands that enjoy the highest level of protection. So they're on the roads. There's almost no trace of human development, right? And so these are places that are supposed to be completely protected from human influence, although it is impossible now, as we know, with climate change. But that's sort of the logic of them, right? So you have wilderness areas. You also have, of course, national parks. Now, national parks are not called wilderness parks. You can actually build stuff and build roads in national parks. Actually, most visitors to American national parks use their cars to get there and usually do not stray away very far from their cars. But anyway, when Americans go to national parks, most of them go to the wilderness, right? So this is a word that is very often used. Another example of the prominence of the notion of wilderness in American society is, for example, the fact that one of the most prominent and influential environmental organizations in the U.S. is called the Wilderness Society. It was created in 1935. By, among others, Aldo Leopold. You will hear about Aldo Leopold in the second presentation today. Very important environmental philosopher, among other things. Okay. So the point here is to say that, you know, in many ways, wilderness and the interest in wilderness are as American as apple pie. Very, very, very much in the front and center in American culture. Now, of course, wilderness can mean different things to different people, right? And the meaning of wilderness has changed over time in American history, right? So, for example, British colonists in North America in the 17th and 18th century did use the word wilderness on a regular basis, but they did not mean the same thing as, for example, 21st century American environmentalists, right? So what I want to focus on today is the meanings, I should use in the plural, the word in the plural, the meanings of the notion of wilderness in American culture. And more specifically, I'm going to try and focus on the on how American transcendentalists, which initially was supposed to be a term of abuse, by the way, so how American transcendentalists transformed the meaning of wilderness in American culture in a way that was decisive and in a way that is still influential today. Now, in the second part of my presentation, I will try and define what transcendentalism was, but just for the sake of clarity, just bear in mind that transcendentalism was an intellectual, artistic, and literary movement that emerged in New England in the 1820s, 1830s, mid-19th century, among a group of intellectuals and writers. Okay, but I mean more about the transcendentalists in the second part. Okay, and so my third part as well is about the legacy of the transcendentalist understanding of wilderness. Right, so I will start by talking about how most British settlers in colonial America and then American citizens in the early Republic conceived of wilderness, what they meant when they used the word wilderness, and then I'll move on to the transcendentalist, and I'll finish with the legacy of the transcendentalist vision of nature in American nature to this day, right? So I'm going to talk briefly about the 20th century, and I'll end with a conclusion about the critics, the environmentalist critics of the notion of wilderness in the late 20th century and in the early 21st century. Right, so let's begin with what British colonists and then early American citizens had to say about wilderness, what they meant by the wilderness. Now, from the very beginning of British settlement in North America, I mean, in Virginia, in New England, so, you know, we're talking here about the early 17th century, the majority of people took a highly hostile and antagonistic and aggressive approach to nature as they saw it, and wilderness, right? So, of course, there were exceptions, not many of them, but to cut a long story short, wilderness was regarded as an aberration, as an obstacle, as a problem to be solved, which is, by the way, you know, quite understandable, right? I mean, you know, they had very vulnerable communities at the beginning. They had to develop those communities, and they needed to exploit the natural world to do that, right? And so I want to start by talking about a very high-profile and very famous example, that of the New England Puritans, right? So New England Puritans were religious fundamentalists who had to leave Britain because they were seen as politically dangerous by the crown, and so they decided to relocate in New England in the hope of setting an example for the rest of the world and of being able to go back to Britain to reform the Church of England. And so, interestingly enough, those New England Puritans, when they arrived, when they made landfall in New England in the early 17th century, did use the word wilderness on a regular basis to describe the landscapes they were encountering. Okay, the fact that most Native Americans had died because of European germs a couple of centuries before helped this impression of being in a wilderness, because, you know, it is estimated that about 85% of Native Americans had died by the time they arrived. And so John Winthrop, who was the first governor of the Massachusetts Bay Colony, which was tasked with developing British settlements in New England, actually famously described the landscapes that he observed in New England as a howling wilderness, okay? And of course, those Puritans approached the world, interpreted landscapes, nature, history, social relations through the lens of the Bible, right? So the Bible really shaped their worldview, and of course, nature was no exception. All right, so when they use the word wilderness at the time, this evoked, first of all, the world after the fall. Right, so after the fall from the Garden of Eden, Adam and Eve found themselves in a wilderness. Okay, so a place that did not compare very favorably with the Garden of Eden, a place characterized by chaos, danger, evil. And so, you know, this was very, very much in the minds of those New England Puritans. The word wilderness in the Bible is also used to refer to the place where Jesus had to resist the devil's temptations for 40 days. So again, a place with very highly negative connotations, a place where you can be tempted by the devil, where you can lose your moral bearings, you can lose your way, right? So not a very, very positive way of looking at the world around, right? And by contrast, many of those Puritans saw it as their mission to civilize the wilderness. In other words, to turn it into a place reminiscent of the Garden of Eden, right? So this was very, very much on their minds. I mean, they had to work very hard, of course. This was not easy. But anyway, that's sort of how, you know, the first Americans, although those people did not view themselves as Americans, they are, you know, in retrospect seen as the first Americans. That's how they conceived of the natural world around them. If you're interested in digging further into this, I would strongly recommend you to have a look at quite an old book, but still, you know, a very, very good book by Roderick Nash called Wilderness and the American Mind. So, it's an overview, historical overview of U.S. perceptions of wilderness, and there's a very, very good chapter about the Puritans and how they conceived of the natural world around. Okay? Now, so much for the New England Puritans. More broadly, if you look at how early American colonists and then early American citizens viewed the natural world, there is no doubt, no question, that they tended to take a fundamentally instrumental approach to nature and the natural world. And it's probably useful very quickly to remember the importance of private property rights from the very, very, very beginning of American history, right? So this emphasis on the idea that you were going to own a piece of land individually without being interfered with by outside forces. Okay, this is part of the DNA of American culture, right? For example, I mean, before I dig deeper into this, I'm sure you've heard about shale gas, you know, le gaz de schiste, right? They're exploiting a lot of shale gas in the U.S., and we are not in Europe, although we do have also some reserves, significant reserves, and there are several reasons why we don't. But one of the reasons why it is so easy to exploit shale gas in the U.S., and it's not here, is that the U.S. is the only country in the world in which a property owner owns the underground part of their property. So, for example, you know, I don't have a house, but suppose I had a house and there was shale gas, I could exploit it. Then I would. This would not be my gas in France. It would be in Nebraska. And so, you know, that's a specificity of mining law in the U.S. So it goes back all the way to not only the early republic, but the reason why. Those mostly European people, decided to take the very risky trip to North America, right? So we hear a lot about religious and political persecution. That's true, you know, you can take the example of the Puritans. But the main driver behind the sort of mass European migration to North America was the appetite for land, right? This thirst for land property, right? I mean, one of the distinguishing feature of North America was that, you know, there was no landed aristocracy. There were Indians, of course, but you could kill them and replace them. There was a lot of land anyway, a lot of resources. Whereas in Europe, in old Europe, it was smaller, and anyway, most of the land was owned by a limited number of people, right? So that was one, probably the main reason why so many Europeans relocated in North America, right? And so this goes a long way toward explaining why there's so much emphasis on the private ownership of the land, right? So I'm not going to read all of those quotes, but these are examples. Going back to the revolutionary generation, of the centrality of private property in the minds of influential Americans who belong to the revolutionary generation, right? So Samuel Adams, a radical revolutionist from Massachusetts, went on record as saying, it is acknowledged to be an unalterable law of nature that a man should have the free use and sole disposal of the fruit of his honest industry, subject to no control. Okay? So in this context, of course, you know, the wilderness is an aberration to be erased, an obstacle to be overcome, and the idea is that, you know, the only limit to what you can do with the land is the amount of work you're able to put in, right? How hard you're prepared to work. I mean, these people were not having it easy, right? I mean, they could acquire land very easily, but then you had to cultivate the land. Most of them were very incompetent, by the way, at exploiting the land. The only exception you will not be surprised to hear were the Germans, who were not part of Germany at the time, but you know, cultural Germans. But most of, you know, the rest of them just destroyed the land they acquired and then moved on. It was very easy to do so, right? So a good example that is very often given is the fate of New England forests, right? So, as I said, you know, when the New England Puritans arrived in New England, they encountered what they saw as a wilderness, partly because many of the Native American communities had collapsed after encountering Europeans. And it is estimated that by the mid-19th century, New England states like Connecticut and Rhode Island had consumed 70% of their forests, right? I mean, you know, a forest can disappear and then regrow. You know, it's not necessarily forever, but it takes time. And, you know, what regrows is not necessarily as biologically diverse as what there was before. But that's really spectacular, right? And so let me be very clear about this. No one had any problem with this, right? I mean, this was seen as interpreted as a victory of civilization over the wilderness, right? And, you know, I mean, from the perspective of the 21st century, it sounds crass and irresponsible, but at the same time, you have to recognize, I mean, this was before the Industrial Revolution. I mean, you know, the Industrial Revolution came to the U.S. in the mid-19th century, so this was a lot of work. People worked extremely hard to import European agricultural practices to New England. You had to clear forest, and if you don't have any machine, clearing a forest takes a lot of time and energy. So they were very proud of what they did, and they saw it, you know, as a marked improvement on what was going on before. Okay? Before I move to my second part, so, you know, just to summarize what I said, so what I'm trying to say is that dominant attitudes as regards the natural world and what they call wilderness were, you know, mostly negative, hostile, confrontational before transcendentalism. And I wanted to make this point to put U.S. transcendentalism in historical perspective and to sort of underline the sort of original character of their contribution. All right, so let's talk about, we're here to hear about the transcendentalists. So there they are. So the main figures of these so-called transcendentalist movements, so, you know, it was not a club, right? I mean, initially it was a term that was used to discredit those thinkers. And so the most prominent members of these transcendentalist groups were, as you know, Ralph Waldo Emerson, a philosopher and former minister of the faith in Massachusetts, and even more prominent, Henry David Thoreau. Okay, I have to tell you, these are the only two transcendentalist figures I've actually studied. So, you know, I'm not going to lie about this, and I can only address their contribution, right? So, to cut a long story short, those transcendentalists were a group of what we would call today intellectuals, although the word was not used at the time. So people very much interested and invested in literature, in philosophy, in metaphysics. And broadly speaking, those transcendentalists were people who were dissatisfied with the state of American culture, right? So they were sort of disappointed by the American experiment. I mean, we're talking about a very young republic. I mean, the U.S. is still a very young republic today. But, you know, at the time, we're talking about people who were born just a few years after the American Revolution, right? And so they viewed American culture as too conformist, too materialistic. They also were uncomfortable, made uncomfortable by the influence of European art, European philosophy, European poetry, and so on and so forth. Not because they, I mean, they obviously respected all of those contributions tremendously, and they were very much influenced by them, but they also insisted that the United States and American society needed to find their own voices, determined by the local context, right? And to them, so far, what they had produced was a, you know, mostly commercial civilization with no higher purpose than money-making, right? And so I think that it's probably fair to describe American transcendentalism as a late American version of European Romanticism, right? So people who were not—they were not rejected the Enlightenment. They did not reject the Enlightenment. I want to make this very clear. I'm going to repeat this again. But they—you know—they were uncomfortable with the sort of extreme a version of the Age of Reason. They believed that, you know, you had to rehabilitate the emotions, the poetic imagination, that, you know, the right, you needed to find the right balance between rational thinking and the poetic imagination, okay? And so one of the contributions that they made was their attempt at rehabilitating wild nature, what they explicitly called wilderness in American culture, okay? And so to Ralph Waldo Emerson, for example, nature was not to be only valued for what you could, you know, for commodity exploitation, but also for the message that it could convey to Americans and to humans in general. So there was this idea that if you contemplated landscapes, you could actually find a reflection of higher truth, moral truth. Okay, so he was an idealist in philosophy. They also valued nature as a way to be reborn, to be cured. So there was a therapeutic dimension to a contact with nature. So they were very much concerned with a civilization that would be completely cut off from nature. They believed that this would have debilitating influences on American culture. Okay, so for example, they influenced the first landscape architect who build the first city parks in the U.S. Like, you know, the first one was obviously in Manhattan, and the point of those parks was to allow urban dwellers in the United States to be in contact with nature. I mean, it, you know, really depends what you mean by nature, but that was the idea, right? That you needed to remain in contact with nature. A very good example is, of course, that of Henry David Thoreau, who retreated to Walden Pond. It's a place that you can visit, okay? But the problem is that there are too many visitors, so now there's land erosion there. It's not very big, right? It's nice. It's nice enough there in Massachusetts. Now, one should not overestimate what happened at Walden. I mean, it was important because he wrote this book. But you know, he was in contact with people on a regular basis. He would go back to his family every now and then to have a nice meal. You know, this was not, you know, it was not completely cut off from civilization, and that wasn't the point anyway, right? He wanted to sort of reconnect with nature as he saw it, but Thoreau was not, and that's really one of the traps that you have to avoid. He was not anti-civilization, right? He just believed that you needed to retain a wild dimension to the human experience, that, you know, what was dangerous was not a civilization, but civilization without any influence from the wild, okay? So There's a quote from an essay that he wrote at the end of his life, Walking, in which he states his objective: I wish to speak a word for nature, for absolute freedom and wildness, so not wilderness here, but wildness more generally as a notion, as an attitude to life, as contrasted with a freedom and culture merely civil. To regard man as an inhabitant or a part and parcel of nature rather than a member of society. I wish to make an extreme statement. If so, I may make an emphatic one, for there are enough champions of civilization, the minister and the school committee, and every one of you will take care of that. And I will take care of the promotion of wilderness in American culture. Now, at this point, I want to go back to what I said about the Enlightenment, right? So I said that American transcendentalism can be singled out as an American version of Romanticism, and I stand by this statement, of course. But I want to repeat that it should not be seen, in my opinion, as an irrational rejection of science and Enlightenment thinking. Right? What Thoreau and Emerson were rejecting was what they viewed as the supremacy of instrumental reason that could marginalize aesthetic and spiritual concerns, right? Thoreau, for example, notoriously spent 3 hours a day every morning rambling in the forest near his home to observe the natural world. He was a very skilled and competent amateur naturalist, okay? There's no question about this. And so transcendentalist science, I think, can be described as a blend of reason, empiricism, aesthetics, and the poetic imagination. So you have to inquire into the natural world. You have to understand, make sense of the natural world using the tools of science. But you should never, never forget to admire the natural world, to be inspired from it, to marvel at it. Right, so that was sort of the message, right? And so here is an extract from another of his books, The Maine Woods, that was published posthumously during the Civil War, by the way. In this extract, he talks about a will-o'-the-wisp. I'm not entirely sure you know what a will-o'-the-wisp is. So it's a fufule. So fufule is a perfectly explainable natural phenomenon, okay? But it can be surprising. And here is what he had to say about it. Right, so he is in the Maine woods, so in the state of Maine, and he sees a will-o'-the-wisp, and then he writes, quote, "A scientific explanation, as it is called, would have been altogether out of place there. Science, with its retorts, would have put me to sleep. It was the opportunity to be ignorant that I improved. It suggested to me that there was something to be seen if one had eyes." So, you know, this can be referred as the poetic imagination. "It made a believer of me more than before. I believed that the woods were not tenantless, but chock full of honest spirits, as good as myself any day. Not an empty chamber in which chemistry was left to work alone, but an inhabited house, and for a few moments I enjoyed fellowship with them. Your so-called wise man goes trying to persuade himself that there is no entity there but himself and his traps, but it is a great deal easier to believe the truth." Now, again, what he's trying to do here is he's trying to make room for spiritual and aesthetic concerns. He's not trying to discredit the scientific method, I think. And central to his thinking, and also to the thinking of Ralph Waldo Emerson, was a recognition of the limits of human knowledge, right? So not a rejection of the scientific method, but an ability to accept the limits of human knowledge and to be comfortable with those limits, okay? Now, I want to turn to the word ecology. So you always have to be very careful with this word. I mean, remember that ecology is a science, okay? Very complicated science. So what I mean by ecology, so the word ecology was actually coined after Thoreau died, okay, just a few years after he died, by a German biologist, Ernst Haeckel, who was an admirer of Darwin. But I think it's probably possible to say that there's a proto-ecological dimension to the transcendentalist approach to nature and the wilderness, right? So ecology before ecology, and by that I mean that I want to go back to the etymological origin of the word ecology, oikos, and this idea that everything is related to everything else, that you should not look at natural phenomena in isolation, okay? You should actually try and look at the broader picture and take into considerations the multiple interactions that are going on in the natural world, right? And so this is actually present, I would say front and center, in transcendentalist literature, right? So nature is not seen as a mechanical instrument, but really as a living organism, right? You take a holistic, comprehensive approach to the natural world. At the time, they put the emphasis on what they call the harmonious dimension of the natural world. I mean, this is now very much disputed by a lot of natural scientists. You know, there's also an element of chaos and rupture sometimes in nature, and this is not something that they recognize. They emphasize the harmonious functioning of the natural world. This was very much in line with 18th century Enlightenment thinking, and also with the romantic approach to nature, okay? So nature as a whole, emphasis on interconnections, multiple interrelations, everything's related to everything else, okay? And this idea that nature can work in a harmonious way, right? That was central. I think it is still central. I'll talk about this in my last part, which is coming soon, I promise. This is still central to the thinking of a lot of contemporary American environmentalists, and this is a sort of source of tension today. But more about this later. The last point I want to make about the transcendentalist is their ambivalence toward material progress. Now, I want to be very, very, very cautious here again, right? I mean, if you identify those thinkers as anti-progress, period, I think you're on the wrong track. It's probably more complicated than that. So first of all, like, you know, you're historians, you know that in the Western world, progress was sort of the dominant paradigm of the 19th century, hence the you know, unusually high interest in the study of history in the 19th century, of course. You're aware of this. And this was also, you know, this was before 1914, before Europe committed suicide. In the early 20th century, this was before the nuclear bomb. So, you know, really the sort of the golden age of the ideology of progress. The ideology of progress is still with us today, of course. There's no question. But, you know, this was really the moment when faith in progress was probably hardest to challenge, right? And so those transcendentalist thinkers, although they did not reject the nascent industrial order. So the Industrial Revolution in the U.S. began in the 1840s, 1850s, and then it accelerated dramatically after the end of the Civil War in the second half of the 19th century. But, you know, in Thoreau's and Emerson's lifetime, the signs of industrialization were very clear for everyone to see. New England was a very good example and a hotspot of industrialization in the U.S., right? And so they did not reject entirely what was going on. They were fascinated by some aspects of technological innovation at the time. But at the same time, they also tended to distance themselves from a blind faith in progress. Mostly, not entirely, but mostly in the name of wilderness and the protection of wild nature. And say, okay, fine, we have this new industrialized civilization, but the last thing we want is to take a purely instrumental approach to nature, to the land, to natural resources, and to forget about what nature and the wilderness can contribute to the human experience. And that's, I think, how you have to interpret. I mean, you can interpret however you want, but that's how I interpret this very famous line by Thoreau: in wildness is the preservation of the world. Not in wilderness. It is very often misquoted as in wilderness, but it's actually broader, in wildness. So, you know, wildness is to be found in the wilderness, but also in human attitudes, in human art. And so the point here is, say, as you industrialize, as you go through this very deep transformational process, don't forget about what is why, what is outside human influence that can teach us moral lessons and help us to grow as individuals. That's my last part, although my conclusion is a bit long. But what I want to do here is, so the point I make in my third part is that American transcendentalists set trends for American preservationists and American environmentalists in the late 19th century and in the course of the 20th century, right? So I'm going to argue that their legacy is enduring. The transcendentalists are very often credited for sort of kick-starting the American environmental movement. I think that the most important factor behind this, the emergence of this movement in the late 19th century and early 20th century, was the Industrial Revolution rather than the Transcendentalists, because as you know, an Industrial Revolution changes everything about the way people behave, their expectations, and how they view nature as well. But anyway, the Transcendentalists, especially Henry David Thoreau, are seen as environmentalist heroes today in the United States and beyond the borders of the United States. So now what I want to do is that I'm going to go through the four points I listed about the transcendentalist approach to nature, and I'm going to try and demonstrate that those ways of interpreting the natural world have endured in environmentalist circles in the U.S. So first of all, you know, the low-hanging fruit, the importance of wilderness in environmental advocacy and environmental activism in the United States. We're going to hear about European approaches to wild nature, so-called wild nature. But, and I'm very curious to hear the second presentation, but there's no question that in the U.S., the defense of wilderness, the protection of wilderness, has always been front and center in environmental advocacy, right? Highly valued by many environmentalists. You know, John Muir, maybe you've heard about John Muir, born in Scotland, but who achieved fame in the U.S. as a tireless promoter of the national park system. Alder Leopold, you'll hear about him, and more recently people like Dave Foreman and many other environmentalists. Remember what I said in my introduction, the Wilderness Society. So-called Wilderness Society, is one of the most prominent environmental organizations in the U.S., okay? And so there's a quote here from David Brower, who was the leader of the Sierra Club, one of the oldest environmental organizations created in the U.S., created in the late 19th century by John Muir, among others. Brower was instrumental in giving the Sierra Club a national audience and making it a really powerful organization. And here is what he had to say about the importance of wilderness for American environmentalists in the 1950s. The concept of wilderness preservation is new. It is a mark of our maturity, of our realizing that there is much more to human progress than finding new places for concrete and steel and the tangible, visible marks of progress. Now, this sounds very, very similar to what I talked about in my second part. And so, for example, in the mid-1950s, David Brower and the Sierra Club and other organizations achieved unprecedented success when they managed to secure the cancellation of a dam within a national monument. So a national monument is a reserved area similar to a national park. It's not exactly the same, but it's very similar. So in Utah, this place that you see here was supposed to be flooded as a result of the construction of a dam. A lot of dams were being built in the U.S. at the time. Environmentalists took exceptions to this, and they managed, which was a first, to prevent the construction of the dam in the name of wilderness preservation, right? Explicitly in the name of wilderness preservation. All right. I mean, there was another dam built somewhere else. I mean, they continued to build dams, but now environmentalists from then on were being prominent players, acting as prominent players. Another example is the creation of the wilderness areas that I reference in my introduction, right? So the first, so first of all, a wilderness area, as I pointed out early on, is a designated area with almost no human alteration, okay? They often call them roadless areas. So, you know, if you want to die, it's a good place to go, okay? You're going to be alone and there, I mean, it's not, they don't, you there's almost no sign of human development there, okay? And so the point here again is explicitly, the truth is in the pudding, that's the name, right? Wilderness areas, to keep nature wild. I mean, in the context of climate change, this is becoming more and more debatable, and I'll talk about this in my conclusion, which is coming, I promise. But you see here, right? I mean, they came up with this idea in Gila, New Mexico in 1923. And in 1964, they passed the Wilderness Act. Congress passed the Wilderness Act, which created a network, a system, I should say, of wilderness areas, and a framework to add new wilderness areas on public lands, right? Which was presented by a lot of members of the Forest Service because they wanted to exploit timber in their forest, but anyway, they had to do it, okay? And you see here, right, the wilderness, in contrast with those areas where man and his works dominate in landscape, is hereby recognized as an area where the earth and community of life are untrammeled by man. This was before feminism, where man himself is a visitor who does not remain. Women are actually allowed to visit those areas, you won't be surprised to hear, okay? So you have a you can have a an idea of wilderness preservation and federal land. Although you know states can also preserve federal land. You see that a lot of land is preserved in the U.S. So the level of protection is not the same everywhere, right? I mean, you know, as I said, you can build a lot of things in a national park. They even wanted to organized the 1932 Olympics in Yosemite National Park in 1932. They lost to Canada. Well, that was the idea that you were going to develop. So there are different ways of approaching this. Whereas wilderness areas are, you know, there's no Olympic going on in a wilderness area. Okay? Okay, so number one, the importance of wilderness for American environmentalists. Now, I want to say a word about the sort of transcendentalist approach to science as I defined it in my second part. Of course, you know, science and ecological research are often at the heart of environmentalist activism in the US and elsewhere, of course. But what's interesting about this is that, so, you know, today, for example, with climate change, you hear a lot of disputes about, you know, what the science says and what President Trump and most Republicans have to say about science. So this is front and center. It's valued by those environmentalists. You know, same for biodiversity loss. But at the same time, what you see is that, you know, historically, a lot of American environmentalists have been uncomfortable with the potential excesses of science, especially of the applied sciences in the form of technological innovation, right? And so on the one hand, they very much rely on scientific research to make their case for wilderness preservation. But on the other hand, they're also worried that the centrality and supremacy of modern science can actually be a way for modern humans to further their domination on nature. That's one of the most important dividing lines among environmentalists. I'll say more about that. So there's a quote. So this is from a novelist, Edwin Abbey, radical environmentalist. This is an extract from a novel, The Monkey Ranch Gang, about, you know, a group of environmental radicals in the U.S., and here is what it had to say in this book about the engineer's dream. So the engineer's dream, so applied science, is a model of perfect sphericity. The planet Earth, with all irregularities removed, highways merely painted on a surface smooth as glass. Of course, The engineers still have a long way to go, but they are patient, tireless little fellows. They keep hustling on like termites in a territorium. I didn't know this word. It's steady work, and their only natural enemies, they believe, are mechanical breakdown or downtime for the equipment, and labor troubles and bad weather, sometimes faulty preparation by the geologists and surveyors, right? So the point here is that, you know, sure, you will embrace science, you will practice the natural sciences yourself, you will rest your case for environmental protection on science, but at the same time, you have to be, you should not be too cozy with scientists and engineers, because they might actually further the human domination and transformation of the wilderness, okay? Another, my third parallel has to do with ecology, ecological thinking. So remember, that's actually a good illustration of what I talked about when I said that, you know, there's an ecological worldview, an ecological frame of mind. So I think it's very well encapsulated in this quote by John Muir that I talked about early on in my first summer in the Sierra. We're talking about the Californian Sierra Nevada here. When we try to pick out anything by itself, we find it hitched to everything else in the universe, right? So emphasis on interconnection, everything is related to everything else. You have to be extremely cautious about how you handle nature, because there are unintended consequences, right? And this is becoming even more prominent today with the notion of the Anthropocene, l'Anthropocène, right? So it's a bit of a intimidating word to refer to the new geological era in which humankind has entered as a geological force in itself, right? And so this has, and we can talk about this during question time, all sorts of ramifications for wilderness, right? Because wilderness is the idea that you can have nature shorn and protected from human influence. But then if you accept the idea of the Anthropocene, there is no outside, right? I mean, everything is affected by human activities. This seems to be the message conveyed by a lot of climate scientists very persuasively. And it has all sorts of repercussions for wilderness. You don't have to be physically present in a place or to build something in a place to affect it through human activities. And so here it sort of gives more credibility to this ecological way of thinking, but it undermines the case for wilderness as something that either never existed or that can no longer exist. And the last parallel I want to make is their ambivalence toward economic and material progress, something I touched on earlier on. Most of my research today is about the political and cultural debate about climate change in the United States. The news is not good, let me tell you. The point here is that what I'm struck by, one of the things I'm struck by, is the tensions between environmentalists who emphasize technological solutions to the problem and environmentalists who want to prioritize an ethical approach to climate change, right? And so there's no love lost, there are a lot of tensions. There's a book, if you have time for this, it's a very good book that was published a bit more than a year ago by an American journalist called Charles C. Mann, called The Wizard and the Prophet. So, you know, and he tries to define identify two groups in American environmentalism: the prophets, who want to emphasize ethical change and the idea that we have to adopt a new paradigm to reject the current paradigm, which is responsible for our current environmental predicament. And then you have those who want to use science and technology and further the human transformation of nature with a way to mitigating climate change or helping humankind to adapt to climate change. It's a very good book. You know, it's an overview of many debates in environmentalist circles in the U.S. over history. Okay, and so the transcendentalists did make their own contribution to this debate in their own way. Now, to conclude, I want to say a few words. I mean, as far as I can understand, the idea for you is to be able to use this knowledge for what you could do in class. And so there are many ways in which you can do it. I'm sure you'll come up with interesting ways of addressing this. But if I were to do it today, I would probably try and look at the environmentalist critics of the idea of wilderness. Not, you know, I'm not talking about people who hate environmentalists, who think that climate policy is a waste of time. Those people are very influential. They're very important. I spend a lot of time studying their thinking and their strategy. But that's not who I'm talking about here. I'm talking about people who view themselves as environmentalists, who explicitly care about the environment, nature, the earth system. I mean, you know, there are many different ways of referring to those realities, okay? And so what's interesting is that in the late 20th century and early 21st century, it so happened that more and more people who were sympathetic to environmentalism were becoming critical of the idea of wilderness. And this has created a lot of controversy. So if you're interested in that, you can look at a collection of articles entitled The Great New Wilderness Debate. You can actually find it here at the library, here at the Bibliothèque Diderot. There are actually two volumes. And it's a compilation of articles about, you know, what wilderness actually means, whether wilderness is actually something real or it's just an idea, and if it's an, is it a good idea? Is it useful? Is it counterproductive? And so I want to give you the example to finish my presentation of a prominent American environmentalist called J. Baird Callicutt, who actually edited this volume. Callicutt went on record as explaining that wilderness was now a problem for American environmentalism. That, for example, wilderness areas should be given a new name. That, you know, the fact that they are called wilderness areas is, you know, creates more problems and more confusion than it helps. Okay, and so the reason why he and others took issue with the idea of wilderness and its importance in environmental advocacy is that, as far as they're concerned, the idea of wilderness perpetuates the idea of a clear-cut dichotomy, a clear-cut separation between humans on the one hand and nature on the other, right? That's two radically distinct and separate spheres, okay? And so, as far as Callicutt is concerned, this view, this way of approaching nature clashes with the lessons of Darwinism and the lessons of ecology, this idea that everything is related to everything else, all right? Ecology, Darwinism suggests that the human species belongs to nature, is part of nature, as indicated by Thoreau in one of the quotes I made earlier on. And so what he's saying is that as an environmental philosopher, he's saying, well, we should actually recognize this fact and then modify our behavior as a consequence of this. You know, recognizing that we are part of nature, that we have a responsibility and an interest in preserving nature. Okay, and so for him, he doesn't want to stop protecting wilderness areas, but he wants to give them a new name. And in order for wilderness to stop being an obstacle, right? So there's a quote here: faced with the harsh realities of the coming century, the wilderness idea is by itself too little, too late, right? The context of the Anthropocene, in which human activities is a geological force. And it is too defensive to save the planet and all of us, its people, from ecological collapse. We need to integrate wildlife sanctuaries into a broader philosophy of conservation that generalizes Leopold's vision of a mutually beneficial and mutually enhancing integration of the human economy with the economy of nature.